Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Well, let's see. This week, the news is going to be healthcare, and then healthcare, and then some more healthcare. Today, you thought the public option was complicated? Wait till you hear what might replace it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing and online surveys. ConstantContact.com. And by MassMutual, sponsoring the retirement planning documentary Retirement Revolution, September 15th on PBS. Local listings at PBS.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Good to have you here. It is the 8th of September today. President Obama heads to Capitol Hill tomorrow night looking to bring some elusive consensus to the healthcare debate. The healthcare news of this Tuesday, however, comes from the Senate Finance Committee. It's mulling the idea of something called regional insurance cooperatives. Yes, that's a mouthful, but it's also a phrase you may hear a lot this fall, as Joel Rose reports.
So what exactly is a regional insurance co-op? That can be hard to say, even for North Dakota Senator Kent Conrad, who's been pushing the idea all summer on cable TV.
A cooperative is membership-owned and membership-run. So it's a nonprofit alternative to for-profit insurance companies.
In other words, it's a nonprofit company that would sell health insurance to some of the 47 million Americans who don't have any. If you've ever bought a policy through a mutual life insurance company, it's the same idea. But it would only be insurance. It's not the same thing as a health co-op, where doctors work on salary. Paul Hazen is CEO of the National Cooperative Business Association. In theory, he says insurance co-ops run by their members could offer cheaper coverage than for-profit companies.
They're not-for-profit businesses, they don't have outside stockholders to reward, and they provide a competitive yardstick in the marketplace.
You could say the same thing about the so-called public option. And like that plan, which many conservatives oppose, co-ops too would rely on public dollars, at least at first. The idea has its critics, including Paul Ginsberg at the Center for Studying Health System Change. He thinks co-ops might be too small to offer much of a discount.
I'm not convinced that they would run their businesses that much differently, because if they did, they would be losing money.
Still, if co-ops can help an overhaul bill squeezed through Congress, Ginsburg says that in itself could be a big step forward. I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
Healthcare does seem to have sucked all the air out of Washington the past couple of months. But as Marketplace's Tamara Keith reports, there are still some weighty issues left undone.
If you're interested in anything else besides healthcare, just keep telling yourself the following.
I actually do think that the Congress is capable of doing more than one thing.
Congress has the ability to do two or more things at once.
Those were advocates Steve Cochran at the Environmental Defense Fund and Eric Halperin at the Center for Responsible Lending. Both hope Congress will find time for their issues, energy legislation and financial reform. Steve Cochran is still sunny on cutting carbon emissions.
I think the public actually believes this is a good thing to do.
And Eric Halperin says there's bipartisan support for financial reform.
So I think there's that sense of urgency that we need this in place in order to move forward with the economy.
But Bruce Jostin, the chief lobbyist for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, says it's all too ambitious.
By trying to do so much so fast, the public is being lost.
Jostin says it's risky to try to pass all this legislation at once.
What, in fact, we're talking about here are transformative pieces of legislation.
Whether any of it lands on the president's desk depends on health care, says Norm Ornstein at the American Enterprise Institute.
It's a little bit like a baseball player who gets on a hot streak. You hit a few balls really well, and all of a sudden you believe you can hit them all. And so what happens over the next few weeks will have a lot to do with whether we get a hot streak or a slump.
In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
Gold hit $1,000 an ounce today, the first time that's happened since February. Back then, investors were worried Citigroup was about to go under. That's not much on investors' minds anymore, but still, prices have been marching higher. Marketplace's Elisa Roth looked into why investors are going for gold right now.
Talk to analysts about why a lot of investors are buying gold, and there's only one thing they seem to agree on. Gold bugs are nervous about everything. Jeffrey Christian follows gold for the CPM Group, a commodities research and consulting company. He says gold buyers are worried about the dollar being weak, but that's just the beginning.
Weakness not only in the dollar, but in other currency markets. They're concerned about inflation. They're worried about the stock market falling. They see very low interest rates on interest-bearing assets. There's concern about the political, economic, and financial stability of various systems, both in the United States and worldwide.
Other people who follow the market give other reasons for the gold rush. The weak dollar makes it cheaper for foreigners to buy gold, demand from investors in developing countries, oil prices. And right now, there's another factor, too, seasonal demand. John Licata's research firm, Blue Phoenix, focuses on metals and energy. He says in September, people in India start buying lots of gold for one reason.
The beginning of Indian wedding season, which is historically a very important driver for the price of gold from late September to December.
The price of gold has been going up for much of the year, and most people seem to agree that it'll stay high at least into the beginning of next. Jeffrey Christian, the analyst, put it this way.
When the world becomes a more stable place economically, financially, and politically, then you would expect people to back off from gold.
In other words, gold could be expensive for a long time. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Gold was up, oil was up, so were stocks. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The United Nations is moving ahead on greenhouse gas emissions, with or without the United States. The UN is working on a new global warming treaty that's set to be formalized in Copenhagen this December. Commentator Dan Esty says Congress not getting its act together and passing a U.S. climate change bill before that would just be a cop-out.
The Obama administration's negotiating team is likely to arrive in Copenhagen empty-handed. That means the prospect for real success in tackling climate change this year is all but dead. If the U.S. committed to its own legislation, slashing greenhouse gas emissions, then other nations, including China and India, would find themselves pressed to commit to emissions controls as well. But without legislation, the United States cedes its leadership role in Copenhagen this December, making substantial progress on a new global treaty impossible. For Copenhagen to lead to a meaningful global accord, the principle of common but differentiated responsibility must be revived. Every nation must be part of the solution. No country can be allowed to sit on the sidelines. Of course, policies and resource commitments will vary depending on a nation's level of development. The United States, Europe, and other wealthy countries will have to make major cuts in greenhouse gas emissions in the coming years, while the big emerging economies like China have to agree to limit the rate of growth in their emissions. But if the United States isn't willing to sign up to shoulder its share of the burden, the effort to mobilize a worldwide response to climate change cannot move forward. Outside Europe, where an emissions control system is now in place, there's little interest in taking action until the United States addresses its own emissions, and the Europeans are growing tired of carrying the load alone. Recent environmental history suggests that real success in global scale issues depends on not just U.S. participation, but U.S. leadership. Scientists tell us that the climate clock is ticking. We may have already passed the point where significant damage from global warming and the associated sea level rise, changed rainfall patterns, disruptions to agriculture, and increased intensity of hurricanes is unavoidable. Simply put, the absence of U.S. leadership leaves the planet in peril. But that seems to be where we are headed.
Dan Esty is a professor of environmental law and policy at Yale University. He was on the U.S. negotiating team that produced the 1992 United Nations Convention on Climate Change. That's the one before the Kyoto Protocols. Take a second to send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on the link that says Contact. The Obama administration does have a couple of other things going on besides healthcare. New regulations for the financial industry, for one. A big part of that overhaul is going to be more protections for consumers, an idea that's not going over too well with business leaders. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce has launched an ad campaign against it that's said to be worth at least $2 million. No mention of the big banks or mortgage lenders and credit card companies that the White House says need to be more tightly regulated. The chamber says instead that the Consumer Financial Protection Agency would wind up hurting American consumers and small businesses. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
The Chamber of Commerce didn't return our call by airtime. It's making its own direct approach to the public with newspaper ads and a clip of its chief economist, Marty Regalia, posted on YouTube.
The broad brush of the proposed Consumer Protection Agency would virtually allow them to go into even small businesses that have an accounts receivable and tell them, well, you know, really, that's a loan.
The print ad pictures a butcher with a warning that even credit extended by a local businessman would be affected, and that could take away many financial choices. Lawrence Glickman wrote a book on the history of consumer activism in America. He says the Obama administration, already on the ropes in another fight, might be seeing opponents using the same playbook.
It will be interesting to see, as this campaign heats up, whether there's an attempt to turn this into something parallel to what we're seeing with debates about health reform today, where the opposition is organizations that appear to be grassroots but often kind of have a top-down function.
The University of South Carolina history professor says business groups have fought off the idea of a consumer protection agency for four decades using the same populist theme.
Big business and big lobbies lined up on the side of the ordinary American people.
A coalition of consumer groups is campaigning for the new agency, arguing it would actually make financial choices easier for consumers. But the Chamber of Commerce criticism apparently left supporters of the plan scrambling to come up with a response. A spokesman for one leading consumer group said they were checking to see if some kind of small business exemption might be possible. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
There was an economic theory that was pretty popular a number of years ago. It went something like this. Since a lot of developing economies really have developed, that is, improved their manufacturing or broadened their exports, their prosperity has effectively decoupled from the big Western countries. If our economies went south, decoupling said, Asia and Africa ought to be all right. The Great Recession of 2008-2009 has largely put that theory to rest. But in China, at least, economic recovery seems to have decoupled quite nicely. They are getting better way faster than we are. Our Shanghai Bureau Chief Scott Tong is here to help us understand how and why that's happening. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Kai. How are you?
I'm all right. Listen, do me a favor and channel your inner economist for a minute and remind us how we know that China is doing so well.
Well, let me just give you one number, 8%. That is the government's goal for the growth in the Chinese GDP for this year. And you know what? Bank economists who earlier this year thought that was not going to happen suddenly are saying, you know, 8% suddenly looks pretty good. They're surprised given the weakness that the world and China was seeing earlier in the year. But there are a lot of numbers that look pretty good. Manufacturing, new orders, corporate earnings, auto sales, you put it all together, and most serious economists say, you know, this is a pretty decisive rebound compared to what's happening in the rest of the world.
Well, given what's happening in the rest of the world, how did this happen?
Well, the one thing China does very well is it pours concrete. last year, when exports fell off a cliff and American soccer moms stopped buying sneakers and stuff from China, the government said, we're going to lay out this $600 billion stimulus package, and most of that is going to be bank lending for infrastructure. We're going to build bridges and apartment buildings and lay train tracks. I mean, Kai, the rail project in China is three times the length of the Transcontinental Railroad in the United States. Wow. Now, the question is, can you have too much? Well, the central government the last few days said, whoa, you know, let's ease off a little bit of the bank lending. We may have overcapacity. We may have made too much cement and too much steel. So we're going to back off a little bit.
Right. And the Shanghai stock markets didn't like that at all, did they?
Well, the market lost 20% in August as this chatter was going out there. And the rest of the global markets followed Shanghai down for a couple days.
Well, that brings up the question that's often applied to the American Federal Reserve, which is to say, you know, their job is to take the punch bowl away when the party gets started. That is, change monetary policy so nobody gets too excited. Is that what's going on in China?
Well, in China, what folks drink here is this concoction called baijiu. So the worry was they're taking away the baijiu. Well, most economists actually think the stimulus indeed is going to wear off over time. But there are other parts of the Chinese economy that will take up some of the slack over time. The property market looks like it's coming back. Consumer spending may see an increase before long, and exports may come back a little bit as well. So on balance, most people think this recovery is as secure as we're going to see right now in the world.
There was a school of thought as this recession deepened that perhaps China was going to be the one to pull the world out of the recession. Is that what's happening here?
It depends, Kai, what part of the world we're talking about. I mean, China's certainly getting bigger and bigger and more important. Now, the dumber money says, okay, China can lead everything in the world. The smarter money says, let's think about what China actually is. You know, a lot of people think of China as the factory to the world. Well, I'll suggest it's more the steel mill to the world. And what do steel mills need? They need raw materials, right? So that helps Brazil and Australia that have iron ore and coal and that kind of stuff. Steel mills need energy, which means China's going to buy a lot of things from Russia and Venezuela and Indonesia and the Middle East. And they need heavy equipment, and companies in Japan and Germany and the United States make that kind of stuff. So those are the parts of the global economy that China can affect. Now, what China can't do is be the consumer to save the world. It's not going to save Starbucks or General Motors. There just aren't enough rich Chinese customers to be able to do that. So, you know, China can help some, and most people think that's what's happening right now.
Scott Tong in our Shanghai Bureau. Scott, thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks, Kai.
Coming up, political ads and corporate cash.
I would open myself up to 5 years in prison. That's the penalty. It's not like, oh, they slap you with a little fine. We're talking about criminalizing speech.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials rose 56 points today, about 0.6%, closed at 9,497. The NASDAQ climbed 18 points, nearly 1%, finished at 2,037. The S&P 500 edged up 8 points, about 1%, clocked in at 1025, 1,025. Two European telecom companies announced they were joining forces to create Britain's largest mobile phone operator today. Both AT&T and Verizon rang up about 1% on that news. Kraft Foods did not look quite so tasty. We heard yesterday the company wants to buy British chocolate maker Cadbury. Unfortunately, Cadbury is not interested. Shares of Kraft melted nearly 6% today. A weaker dollar helped push oil above $70. That was good news for petroleum companies. Shares of Chevron and ExxonMobil pumped up 2% today. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Payroll Association, thanking payroll professionals during National Payroll Week, September 7th through the 11th. More at nationalpayrollweek.com. And by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. Now you can take Marketplace with you wherever you go. Tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest business news, decoders that explain financial terms, and updates on the economic crisis.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The Federal Reserve releases its latest Beige Book summary of current economic conditions. It's all about what we eat. The annual National Food Policy Conference continues in Washington. Food safety and child nutrition are the primary focus this year. And California turns 159. The Golden State joined the Union on September 9th, 1850. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
That music from us means it's time for letters from you. We'll start, as many of you are this month, with school and getting back to it. A couple of weeks ago, we did a story on what colleges are doing to offer more practical majors, fields of study that will help graduates actually get ahead when they get their diplomas. We quoted business executives as saying what they really want are employees with critical thinking skills. Eric Bennett from Kansas City, Missouri, would love to meet some of those executives.
I have an engineering degree, and I have changed career paths 3 times, continued education, plus have a proven record of creative problem solving. I have looked nationally for new opportunities, and yet over nearly the past decade, I have been without a paycheck over 40% of the time. Perhaps what businesses say they need and really want are not the same thing.
Let's keep it on education here for just a second, because last week's commentary from George Mason University economist Tyler Cowen didn't sit well with some of you. Professor Cowen theorizes that higher education works something like a placebo, convincing graduates they are smarter and more prepared for the working world than non-graduates are. Because, he said, studying things like Walt Whitman isn't really going to give students a leg up on landing that first job. Dan Eastwood from Waukesha, Wisconsin, wrote in to disagree.
Learning itself is a critical skill which is gained through study. That study might be biology, business, physics, physiology, zoology, or even Walt Whitman. A college degree is an indication that the student is teachable and capable of jumping through the higher hoops of their profession.
As part of our series on what economists do for fun, Justin Wolfer's analysis of his own running hobby sparked some strong reactions. Brad Serwer of Olney, Maryland, wrote in to say that sometimes the benefits of an activity can outweigh the costs.
As both a runner and a cardiologist, I recognize the difficult balance of work and recreation. Considering the fact that this, quote, hobby has such a positive impact on an individual's health, the time spent running really is a small price to pay.
And finally, light bulbs. We reported last week on a new European law phasing out incandescent bulbs in favor of more energy-efficient compact fluorescents, or CFLs. And this one's on me. I set up our story about German consumers stockpiling incandescents by saying CFLs give off a colder light than old-fashioned bulbs do. Andrew Beldikos from Atlanta, Georgia, was just one of many who wrote in to set me straight.
I'm a professional lighting designer. When my clients view incandescent next to various colors of fluorescent, the client will almost always choose the warm-toned fluorescent light source as a more natural and desirable selection.
If you've got a bright idea or a question or a comment, drop us a line. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. The Supreme Court is going to hold a rare instant replay tomorrow. Instant, at least in judicial time. The justices are going to rehear a case from last spring called Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission. As you can gather from the name of one of the parties to that case and from the fact that we're covering it on this program, it's a case about money in politics, about whether companies can buy ads to support or to attack candidates in federal elections. Marketplace's Steve Hannon reports.
The case the Supreme Court hears tomorrow could remake American elections. But when it began, it looked like a minor fight about a pay-per-view documentary called Hillary, the Movie.
Hillary is really the closest thing we have in America to a European socialist.
If you thought you knew everything about Hillary Clinton, wait till you see the movie.
David Bossie is president of Citizens United, the nonprofit group that made the film.
We're a political group. We make political films. We make films that are timely.
And Citizens United accepts individual and corporate money to do it. Groups that accept individual contributions can air ads about candidates right up to Election Day. But corporate money changes that. And that's why Bossie always runs into trouble with the Federal Election Commission, or FEC.
We made this movie knowing we were headed to the Supreme Court.
Bossie planned to run his film during Hillary Clinton's campaign. But officials at the FEC thought it was really a 90-minute attack ad. And because Bossie took a little corporate money to make the film, the FEC told him he couldn't run it on pay-per-view or air the ads for it on television without facing consequences.
I would open myself up to 5 years in prison. That's the penalty. It's not like, oh, they slap you with a little fine. We're talking about criminalizing speech, and not just criminalizing it, but with a massive jail sentence.
So Bossie sued. Michael Toner is a former chair of the FEC. In this case, he filed a brief supporting Citizens United.
Congress didn't intend to focus on pay-per-view type programming and advertising of this nature.
Originally, that's what this case was about. Can the FEC legally ban a pay-per-view film? But instead of deciding that issue, this spring the Supreme Court surprised everyone by asking for a new hearing addressing a different issue. Do corporations have a First Amendment right to political speech? Michael Toner.
It's a very unusual situation to have the court ordering rehearing in a case. It happens very rarely, and it usually only occurs when a number of justices are seriously contemplating overturning established precedent.
Toner believes campaign finance laws have been on a collision course with the First Amendment for years. And this isn't the first time the FEC's interfered with a documentary film.
When we had some airplanes authorized at the highest levels of our government to pick up Osama bin Laden's family members and transport them out of this country.
Back in the summer of 2004, the FEC began investigating Lionsgate and Michael Moore, asking questions about the promotion of Fahrenheit 9/11, which skewered President George W. Bush. Here's David Bossi.
And they actually took their ads off the air as opposed to fighting it. And I found that to be kind of incredible, actually, that the biggest distributors, the biggest movie companies in the country would be afraid of the Federal Election Commission.
The FEC's power has alarmed the ACLU and the Reporters Committee for the Freedom of the Press and major unions. They're all backing Bossie in this case. But campaign finance reform advocates like Trevor Potter say there are half a dozen ways Bossie could have made his movie legally and aired it on TV without breaking campaign finance rules. Potter's a former chairman of the FEC. Now he runs the nonprofit Campaign Legal Center, which promotes enforcement of campaign finance laws.
There isn't a problem. This is an artificial crisis that is created by people who have another agenda.
Potter thinks Citizens United's real agenda has always been to challenge the ban on corporate money in elections and overturn a law that's been on the books for 62 years. If they win,
in essence, you would be giving corporate America the capacity for dominance of our electoral and our decision-making process.
Fred Wertheimer lobbies for strict campaign finance laws at Democracy 21. He points out if ExxonMobil had spent just 1% of its 2008 profits on political advertising in that year's election, it would have outspent both Obama and McCain combined. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, the perils of rushing through a $3 billion government program that was so popular it ran out of money. A couple of days ago at our morning meeting, we were wondering what would happen if after the sale and the rebate had been made, Washington rejected somebody's Cash for Clunkers trade-in. Somebody at the meeting, all right, it was me, said, nah, the rules were pretty clearly spelled out. It couldn't really happen that somebody would be rejected. USA Today says, yeah, it is possible. The numbers are small, but the paper and the car site Edmunds.com are reporting some deals have been indeed kicked back to dealers, on technicalities mostly, and that those dealers are asking consumers for the $4,500 rebate that they got back. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow gained 56 points, about 0.6%. The Nasdaq hiked up 18 points, nearly 1%. The S&P 500 packed on 8 points, about 1% there as well. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Renita Jablonski on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Coming up next time on this program, could the UK's baby boom be a bust?
I believe that Britain certainly has had enough people already, and we might be better off with fewer people. I think it's deplorable that our population total is steadily growing in Britain. It should be going the other way.
Ouch. I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.